Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Good morning. My name is Gordon Routley, and I'm here in Baltimore at Firehouse Expo. And we're here to do a podcast on the safety culture issue in the fire service. And I'm sitting here with a group of distinguished fire service members. To my right, if you could see me, is Sal Cassano, Chief of Department of New York City Fire Department. Immediately to my left is Billy Hayes from the District of Columbia Fire Department, who's now the public education guru of the D.C. Fire Department. To his left is Greg Collier from Mount Laurel, New Jersey, battalion chief in Mount Laurel. And down at the end of the table is Pete Rizzo, who's a retired captain from Rochester, New York. And I think something we all have in common is we all have a relationship to the Firefighter Life Safety Initiatives program through the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. Several of us are either involved in organizing it or as advocates, or and in the case of Chief Cassano, as we saw at the opening session yesterday, is the proud owner of a new video production that's a spin-off from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation program, directed specifically toward New York City and toward the issue of culture. So let me just start off by let's run down the table and see if we can get some opening remarks from each of our commentators here. Chief Cassano.
Yes. Good afternoon, Gordon. As you mentioned at the opening ceremony, we showed a video that was made in conjunction with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. It's Everyone Goes Home, and we felt it was very important to use our members on that video to even hit home harder and hope that we would drive this message home about changing the safety culture in the department. And we used members that had faced close calls. Some had been burned seriously. We had some family members on that lost one was their son, Mr. and Mrs. Thomas Brick. And we had Denise Ford, who lost her husband, Harry, at a fire on Father's Day, the Father's Day fire right before September 11th. And the comments that we've gotten from the field has been really uplifting. We've used some of the shock of showing them how it affects not only the firehouse, but the families and the extended families. And Tommy, in his case, he was married and two young children, but how it affected his parents. And I think that, now that that's going to go across the country, we hope that has an impact on the fire service and we can make a difference in all fire departments.
Yeah, that video is being distributed by the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, and copies are being sent out. I think 30,000 plus copies are being sent out to fire departments across the country, and additional copies will be available. I saw it for the first time yesterday, and I loved it. It's just terrific.
Thank you.
I go back about 4 years to when the idea was first being talked about of putting the video together, and I thought, what would we end up with? And seeing the finished video yesterday, it is just terrific. It really carries the message.
Thank you, Gordon. And that's what we try to do, not only in our department, but in all departments throughout the country.
Yeah, I think everybody is really going to be impressed with it and get a lot of good out of it. Let me pass down to Billy.
Oh, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. As the advocate manager for the Everyone Goes Home program through the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation, we have advocates all across the country, and we've put together an organizational chart similar to a fire department. We're set up very similar to that. Pete and Greg both are advocates within their respective states, but also we have Danny McDonough, who's retired FDNY, and Danny's kind of our liaison to FDNY and does a wonderful job, along with Benny Brennan, working with the foundation. And that's just a sight of where the Courage to Be Safe and the 16 initiatives have actually been implemented. This goes nationwide, as Chief Cassano said. We have success stories from California. We have them from Florida. Just in the next week or so, Florida, at their state chiefs conference, will actually present 38 seatbelt pledge certificates. So I know Dr. Clark, who's in the audience watching us today, he's going to be proud of that. But it's a grassroots level effort. We have to get out there. We have to inform the departments. And I think what's really something we need to focus on, really, I guess, concerning, is that we're now complete of year four in this grant program, and we still have firefighters. I had one call me this week who's at the National Fire Academy talking about the Courage to Be Safe, talking about Everyone Goes Home, and they've never heard of it. So it shows we got to get the message out there. We've got to do a lot more in spreading the word and the safety culture that we're here to talk about today.
Greg, do you want to pitch in with that?
Yeah, and I think that film was fabulous. Last year through our program and Danny McDonough in Region 2, we ran a facilitator's class actually at the FDNY Academy. And one of the participants said, thought it was a great day that we got to do it at the Rock. And he said, why can't we get a department like New York to do something, because there are so many departments in this country to emulate New York City? And I think we've done that. I think we've done that by far. The other thing that I think is important about the culture is our number one initiative number one is to define and advocate the need for cultural change for safety within the fire service, incorporating the management, leadership, accountability, and personal responsibility. And when I teach, I don't tell people that we want to ram that down their throat. I tell them that we want to use those facilitation skills to enable you to define what cultural change you need within your department. There are many departments that are doing some things already. Can they do them better using those management skills of evaluating and looking at what they're doing again, using the supervision skills of watching and checking, using the personal leadership skills? And I think that's what's important, is this has to happen at that grassroots level, which our program is supposed to be, and they can pass that along to their people rather than someone coming in from the outside telling them we're doing this wrong.
Yeah. Pete, what can you add to that for starting?
Well, hi, Gordon, and hello out there to all of our listeners. In New York State, we number about 120,000 firefighters, and the advocacy program has been reaching throughout the state. I hear the word culture being used considerably, and I kind of thesaurus it and look at maybe a basic operational change. Now, all of us at the panel and in the room and those listening have undergone these operational changes, some of them significant, from tin cans on our heads, to modern day equipment, from the use of SCBAs. I know that's my generation. When I came on the job, joined the service, a couple of SCBAs in a suitcase inside the compartment. You know, the dinosaurs, the old dogs, the crusty guys never would break them out. And it was the young guys, myself at the time, when we demonstrated the fact that by using those SCBAs, we're able to get the job done more efficiently, more safely. That culture changed around just in several years. Now, change in several years is something significant when you're talking about an entire country like the U.S. Billy had mentioned the seatbelt pledges, Bert Clark's efforts to just increase the magnitude of the way that seatbelt pledge is going around, and the commitment that we're all making and demonstrating. It's almost, I consider it sometimes marketing. We're trying to reduce firefighter career-altering injuries, line-of-duty deaths in America, maybe let's say one click at a time. And I'd like to take the opportunity, really, to Bert Clark has provided us with a seatbelt pledge, and we've requested Chief Cassano get on board with us and sign that pledge. So I'm just going to pass this along to Chief Cassano. he may have a comment to make to his troops regarding the pledge, and we're looking forward to those numbers quadrupling and reaching out across America. And while the chief is signing that pledge, I'll also add that you folks, if you have not had an opportunity to visit the website for National Fallen Firefighters, please do. Look into receiving delivery of the Courage to Be Safe program. It's great. It's a great program.
Thanks, Pete. And for our listeners out there, this is Sal Cassano, and I just signed the National Fire Service seatbelt pledge. And when I go back, I will have this sheet and hopefully many more filled out by my top staff, who have already made a commitment to ensuring that everybody uses their seatbelt. We know that in times there's going to be accidents, even though we try to prevent them and try to reduce them, there will be accidents, and the best way to survive an accident is to have your seatbelt on. And that's why the FDNY is making a concerted effort as we speak to have everybody wear their seatbelt. So I just signed this pledge for all you listeners. I do it with the most sincere thoughts in my mind, and I know that the people that work for me, starting from my staff chiefs all the way down to my lieutenants and captains, are going to make sure that this is insured, will sign it with me.
Great. It's too bad we're not on television. We could let everybody see you you sign the document. I see Bert Clark sitting over there with a big grin on his face.
I don't think I've ever seen him smile that way.
That's Gordon. I have a better face for radio than TV. So
Yeah, I think that's true of all of us here. But you know, as we talk about the culture issue, I go back to the first the summit session we had back in 1994 in Tampa, when we got you know, all the key fire service players together to look at the issue of firefighter fatalities and how to prevent them. We started off with this idea: we'll invite, you know, all of the major organizations and key players, and we thought, yeah, maybe we get 60 or 70 people down there. We ended up, I think it was 230, ended up being down there, and it was everybody who was anybody in the fire service and every organization, and that's where the 16 firefighter life safety initiatives came from. And pretty much everybody there agreed that number one issue that we had to address was the culture issue. And I think that's when the safety culture issue really became part of the safety movement and known throughout the fire service. And I think a lot of people had a problem just understanding what that's all about. And even today, I talk to people who sometimes react by saying, you know, well, there are a lot of things about the fire service culture that we like and that we're proud of, and you're saying now that we have to change the culture of the fire service to focus on safety. And I think, you know, we're missing something there. As I think the real message is, we have to make safety part of that culture. We don't have to throw away the rest of the culture and stop doing all of the good stuff. We just have to say, incorporate safety, think about safety as one of the primary things that we do. I spend a lot of time, I'm currently working for the Montreal Fire Department, and my origins are in Canada, so I've worked with Canadian fire departments and U.S. fire departments, and I've spent time with fire departments in other parts of the world. So I've seen different cultural aspects. And, you know, I don't think that there's a problem culturally that some people are so safety-focused that they forgot that we showed up to fight the fire and save the people. But clearly there are, you know, in different places, there's just a different emphasis on safety and on culture. I have to say, in Montreal and the province of Quebec, where I am, there's a tremendous focus on safety, which has developed over the last 15 or 20 years. When I started back in the same era, when we had two SCBAs in a suitcase for a five person company, and they were for emergency use only.
Right.
You know, they have come a long way. What do the other folks around the table say about that? How does safety culture integrate with fire service culture in the reality of the fire service today?
Sure, Gordon, Sal Cassano, FDNY. And I think that the message that we try to get out to our members, and I speak to all our promotional courses, and we talk about safety culture, and I'll say, well, what is safety culture? And we tell them safety culture is the way you, as an organization, in our case FDNY, and the individual members of the FDNY effectively deal with risk to avoid injury and loss of life while still achieving your goal to provide life safety and property preservation to the people that live, work, and visit New York City. And what that says is, we're not telling you you can't be an aggressive firefighter. We're not telling you you can't be committed. You can't be brave. You can't be courageous. It's everything that you've done in the past and we've done in the past for the last 144 years as a paid department. But we want you to think about safety in everything you do. From the time you come into that firehouse door, we want you to think safely. And that includes physical fitness. That includes nutrition. That includes no smoking. All of those things come into being a good, safe firefighter. And that's when we talk about the change in the culture where, you know, this bravado of New York City firefighters go through windows and walls and flames. And, well, we're asking you, everything we've done, just do it a little safer. And my job as the chief of the FDNY is to make sure that everybody comes to work that day, goes home safely to their families.
And there's no denying the influence that FDNY has on a big portion of the fire service. There are an awful lot of people who are listening, who watch everything that goes on at FDNY, and so I think when you talk about influencing your people, 13,000 people you have on the line, more or less, you probably influence another 50 or 100,000 who are watching everything that goes on in FDNY.
Oh, and that's and our biggest challenge is to get that message across to our members that you are who you are, and you can do what you've done in the past. Just incorporate safety. We tell them risk management. You risk a lot to save a lot. If there's a life at stake, you're going to risk a lot. If there's a little bit at stake, you risk a little. But if there's nothing at stake, you don't risk anything. And that's the message we're trying to get across.
Yeah, exactly. Now, that's how it works in the biggest fire department in North America, and I guess one of the biggest in the world, if not the biggest. How does it work down with the smaller departments down the line, with the volunteer and combination departments and the size departments that most of the listeners are probably connected to?
Well, in my where I come from, my neighborhood, the culture goes something like this. If you become injured and it was avoidable, you're going to get your shoes busted pretty good. That's not a badge of courage or a badge of honor when you're off injured. It's, embarrassment. You can embarrass your entire company. So I see some of the folks I deal with take kind of that track. It's kind of the hand-me-down tradition also of, yes, we're a strong truck. So I see that working out to our advantage in that way.
Coming from a smaller department pretty much my whole career, now that I work for DC, I've seen the adjustments in what it takes to operate in a larger department. But when I was chief of a smaller department, the luxury of having five engine companies and a couple of trucks and a squad or a rescue and two or three battalions coming to you within a 5 to 6 minute time range just wasn't realistic. What we had to do was change our behaviors, and that's what culture is. And I'm just not a fan of the word culture. I just cannot stand that word. I think it turns out to be an excuse more than anything. It's your behavior. And our behaviors in a smaller department, we had to gauge back, because whether it's in Georgia, whether it's in California or FDNY or Wisconsin, I think everybody joins the fire service to be an aggressive offensive firefighter and to really make that grab, because that's what you're taught in recruit school. Except in the smaller organizations, and you're right, Pete, I think a majority of the people listening are in combination or smaller departments. They have to understand their resources. And it's all about resources. And I put this out. I traveled the nation teaching the Courage to Be Safe class. And if I put this out, I know people are going to go crazy when they hear it. But there's a department that actually has an SOG that says if you arrive on scene and you have full life accountability of the residents outside the structure, meaning their escape plan, their smoke alarm, everything was in system order, and they're at the meeting place and say, we're out of the house. We're out of the house. That fire department is in an exterior operation. Now, when I say that, people go crazy. How can you do that? That's not what we get paid to do. We get paid to fight fire, and there's firefighters that say, we get paid to die for property just as much as we do lives. The difference in that is I throw out there, they arrive with two people on an engine. They may not have their next engine for another 10 to 15 minutes. They understand what Chief Cassano said, the risk-benefit analysis, and they understand the risk in one of their volunteers is not worth the property. And people get upset by saying that, but the reality of how smaller departments in our country has to operate is the truth of it.
And that is a reality because, you know, we go from one end of the scale where, you know, companies in New York City show up with, you know, with five or six people on the apparatus. If they're running with five, they're feeling deprived because, you know, they're missing somebody to, you know, to a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, out there are, you know, are involved with departments where two people on the same rig is a task force. You know, they have to work that way. Greg, you work in a combination system where you have some of each.
We have two 24-hour staffed companies and a daytime career staff, and that same company is nighttime volunteer, and they do a shift. And I took the opportunity to take today's agenda before I contemplated what I was really going to say. I went to my two 24-hour companies because I work with those same guys every day. I said, guys, help me with this. I'm doing a podcast. And I got a wide array of comments from defending that aggressive position and creating a fight between the aggressive and the safety. And one of my companies was quite clear, and I looked at those of the guys that are really good, new, aggressive officer, guys that are testing for promotion, some guys that were a little more timid, who said, we got into great discussion about all the things of the personal responsibility, the organizational responsibility, and they helped each other. And that's what I found value in is, this isn't magic. You know what to do. Just go and do it. You can be aggressive, but you can do it safely. And this is not a fight within our service between each other. It's a team effort, and it has to be, we have to respect each other, but we have to go out and do it safe so that at the end of the day we all go home.
Yeah, I think you know, the we're all influenced by the people we work around, the people who brought us up. I think each of us can think back to when we came on the fire service. And the biggest influence after you got through, you know, the initial recruit training when they filled you full of whatever recruit training did. Then you get into the environment of the firehouse. And then that's the primary influence is, you know, what do people think and how do people behave out there. And I think some of us, you know, most of the guys who are around the department when I first came on were World War II veterans, and you know, and based on their life experience, safety wasn't a really big issue. They were used to ground combat, but you know, the world has changed an awful lot in the intervening 40 years or so, and you know, I see that the belief system and the experience system has come around a lot. But really, it's the, you know, the people who are there now are the influence on the people who are coming in, who are going to be the fire service for the next generation. How are we doing as far as passing on the right messages and the right influences? Are we making a change? Are we making the change in the right direction? Billy?
I think we're getting there. There's a long way to go. We're taking those steps, and certainly I think every department has their own steps that they are taking. But you know, it's not just one individual. It's the organization. And if you're the chief of the department, you have a huge amount of responsibility to your crew. And it's always tough to say for a fire chief to get up in front of a council meeting and say, you know, everyone expects the fire chief to say their number one concern for safety is the safety of the citizens. But if you don't protect your employees, you can't get them to the scene to protect the citizens. So it has to go both ways. But a leader of the organization is not the only one. You have to have those incoming recruits, but you have to have those company officers buy in, because they're truly the leaders in the organization. They really are, because they influence so much of the morale, the behaviors, the attitude. If we can break that point to when those recruits come fresh out of school or join the organization with the idea that this is going to be a safe organization, a safe profession, and those company officers support that, I think that's where we're going to have the success. I think a lot of our focus, true, we need to focus on the new guys coming in, but a lot of our focus has to go on the company officers. That's just my thought on it.
Yeah. Gordon Salcasano, and I couldn't agree with Billy more. We teach our probies all the safest practices in the world. There isn't a safe practice that probie isn't taught, from using your seatbelt to using your chin strap to making sure your hood is up, making sure your gloves are always on, making sure your mask is used as much as possible. And once they get out of probie school, it's like your children leaving home and their friends have a bigger influence on them than you do. Yeah. And we have to have those company officers, the lieutenants and the captains and the battalion chiefs that are out there every day working with them, drilling with them, visiting with them, buy into this program.
Yeah.
And that's what we feel is the most important way to get this message across. That's why I make it a point to speak to my promotional classes, and every promotion speech talks about safety. And you know, even the competition among companies, to say we have to work together. You know, it's not like oh, I'm going to get there first and I'm going to get the fire. It's like, okay, if you get there first, you have the fire, and we're going to support you. And we are getting a tremendous amount of buy-in. The video helped, working with Ron and the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation, and having the support from the commissioner and the chief of department all the way down. To ensure that all these safety initiatives are carried out. If we have a serious injury or a line of duty death, we take a very critical look at the department. We don't sugarcoat anything. We look at it. It takes sometimes a year to do that investigation, but it takes that long so that no stone goes unturned, no error goes unnoticed, and a lot of recommendations come out that force the department to buy certain types of equipment. From a couple of fatal fires, now every chief's car has a battalion recorder on there so that the handy-talky transmissions are recorded from the time the chief gets on the scene, and it allows us to build a timeline. So if the department is going to take a critical look at itself, and with the blessing of the commissioner and chief of the department, certainly the lieutenants and the captains in the field are going to buy in. I think that goes a long way in leadership from the top, and then at least you'll get some buy-in from the people that are going to carry out that mission. Because I'm not in every firehouse. I'm in very few firehouses because of my job. But the people that are working every day are the ones that are going to make sure that this policy is carried out.
Yeah, the message that comes from the top and works its way down through the organization is such a key. And if the people down in, you know, the people who are riding fire trucks and going into burning buildings don't really believe that's what the department expects, then, you know, then the program isn't effective. I've seen that looking around, you know, internationally particularly, what the message that comes from the top of the organization has, you know, influences down through the middle. It may take a generation for that to fully come into effect, but you know, it's certainly clear where that has happened, and it's interesting to see it happening in, you know, in FDNY and some of the other big departments in the U.S.
Well, we know it wasn't going to take. You couldn't turn the ship around very quickly, but we're starting to steer that ship in a different direction, and it's going to take a while. But we are committed to ensuring that, as again, it's a cliche, everyone goes home safe. And, you know, just looking at new gloves right now, because the gloves that we had, we were getting some complaints that they felt they didn't have the dexterity. And we felt committed that instead of having people take off their gloves because they couldn't work with them, we're looking at new gloves, and, you know, by next spring, we're going to have a new, more dexterous glove for the firefighters to wear.
What a concept. We'll get gloves to work.
Yeah.
Gordon, Greg Collier. I think just for some of our listeners out there, some of them will give us a cynical snicker when their leadership doesn't exhibit those behaviors from the top down. But I think followership is as much as important, because followership skills and leadership skills are very similar. You can still do the right thing at the bottom, and the top can see that. And I think that's important for the people who just don't give up. Just keep doing the right thing.
Yeah, no, I think this, Billy, I think it's very important that we don't confuse the fact that just because you're the chief or a company officer, you're the leader and the only leader. The new firefighter coming in has a great amount of leadership influence over the other recruits coming out of school with them or those in the company. So I agree, the leadership followership go hand in hand with
the people we're bringing in today are in their sometimes teens and early 20s, and they've always worn a seatbelt. They weren't allowed out of the hospital into the car. Where at our age, we walked the back of the car on vacation.
Yeah, this is Pete here. I totally agree that the leaders are not always the officers. Out of probie school, you get assigned a company, and somebody at the probie school, an officer, an instructor would say, "Oh, you got a great spot there. You got a great boss and a great crew." So it's the demonstrated methods. It's not the paper that's going to get the job done. And by addressing some of these dynamic rules of engagement, because we're always kind of moving forward with our engagements of incidents, that's where I think we're going to see that generational change kind of come into play from the World War II to the baby boomers, myself, to the X, to the Y, to the electronic generation.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's always been something that's fascinated me, just talking about seatbelts, is, you know, I can remember when seatbelts were invented. So getting people to wear seatbelts was a bit of a struggle. But, for as long as I've had a driver's license, seatbelts have been in every vehicle, and the use has been mandatory. And as far as I can tell, 99% of the people who are riding on fire trucks today grew up in a generation where they've always used seatbelts, or they were always supposed to use seatbelts or legally required. And yet they get on fire apparatus, and I think, you know, again, the peer influence. They say, "Oh no, we don't really fasten our seatbelts back here in the back of the truck. Maybe the driver or the officer do up in the front, but back here where the real firefighters are, we don't do it." So there's an unlearning of behavior that they've had. I'm happy to say that more and more, we're getting past that, and you know, firefighters are wearing their seatbelts, and they are taking that extra second and a half to fasten the seatbelt, and that extra second and a half to get out of the seat when they get to the fire, because they figured out it really is important. It's not important unless you get into an accident, but when you get into an accident, it's really important.
You know, I'd like to comment just by saying that we've seen the sublime to the ridiculous, from defeating the seatbelt alarm systems to literally painting a red stripe across your shirt to indicate your seatbelt is on. But I think that proficiency in utilizing your equipment is one of those things that we can play toward. Yes, I can do this. I can do this properly. I can get the job done and get it done right.
Yeah. You know what? Came up in a conversation I was in a year or so ago, and said, with all the training we do on different things, we never really train firefighters on how to get dressed, get on the apparatus, get belted in. I guess we always take it for granted that, you know, you can figure out how to get your stuff on and get yourself into the seat and get buckled in. But, you know, there's some technique involved to it, and, you know, maybe we need to make that an element of training, so that there's a standard way that we expect you to do that. So, you know, get in, get your stuff on, sit down, fasten this belt, now you're ready to go.
You know, I'll quickly add, go to YouTube, the Denver seatbelt drill. Check it out. Very proficient way to put your seatbelt down while still using all of your other equipment.
Yeah, it's there on YouTube.
Yes, it is.
Like,
yep.
You know, everything I need to know is on YouTube. Okay, we've been talking for about 35 minutes. We're going to take a break for just a couple of minutes so we can hear from our sponsors. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, we're back on the air. This is Gordon Routley, and this is the podcast from Firehouse Expo in Baltimore. I'm sitting here talking about safety culture in the fire service. I'm here with Sal Cassano, the chief department of FDNY, with Billy Hayes from the District of Columbia Fire Department, who else is down at the end of the table? I can't see that far.
Pete Rizzo.
Pete Rizzo's down there. And
Greg Collier is with
us. Greg Collier from Mount Laurel, New Jersey. And we've been talking about culture for a few minutes. Let me start off this second half, and I'll ask Chief Cassano to start. Can you just tell us some of the things that you've done in your department to push the cultural change?
Sure, Gordon. One of the things that we did early on, and that's how we got involved with the NFFF, was we had an injury reduction program where we had officers that are working in the field. These weren't headquarters officers, so that people knew that they were working with these people in the field, go around to every firehouse and do a presentation on how to reduce injuries. And they were taken from actual events where people got hurt. And we explained how they got hurt, how they could have prevented it. And we did that also with an accident reduction program. And our accidents went very, very down, very low. And we attribute that to just an awareness of what causes accidents and what you can do to prevent them. And those are, you know, the accident injury reduction program. And along with that, we tied in with the Everyone Goes Home video. And but those are two of the things that we did pretty quickly. And we got a great response because it showed that the department is making an effort to use line officers that are actually responding every day and know what's going on in the firehouse so that we would get buy-in. And we also partnered with the IAFC and the IAFF, and we use the near-miss program. And we think that that's important because that gives people in the field a chance to say, wow, we had a near-miss. Here was the experience. It's online. It's on the web. Every firehouse has the computer to go on and review them. And, you know, lessons learned. We have a pass-it-on program where we do have a close call, and we'll print out a whole bulletin on the incident and what happened and what steps were taken to avoid that so that people can say, this can happen to you. And there's so many different things. I mean, we have our own 16-point initiative. We have a Division Safety Committee quarterly meeting where all the deputies in the battalion sit down, and there's a member of each rank, and they'll talk about just what's hot in the field of safety, what happened in the battalion or division that we need to get a message out to the rest of the job. We have a big department. We have 11,500 firefighters, almost 3,000 EMTs and paramedics. So what's going on in Staten Island may not be talked about in the Bronx. And these safety committees are very important so that after the notes are given, we'll get that out to the rest of the field and say, hey, this is what happened over here. Just because it happened in Staten Island, that doesn't mean it can't happen in Queens. It's just a way to get out the message. And one of the things that we felt was very important is we actually developed a risk management plan where every injury and every serious injury and every line of duty death is weighed and measured. As I spoke about before, it's looked at critically. Not critically at only the what happened at the scene, but was the department at fault for not providing a type of equipment. So that if we can look at ourselves from within, it certainly sends out a strong message to the field that this isn't looking to point fingers. This is looking to improve and prevent another death or an injury that happened. Right now in New York, there's a fire going on in a Con Ed plant, the Con Ed facility, utility. And through the efforts of working with all the utilities in New York and sitting down and developing SOPs or SOGs, they fought that fire from the outside. And they didn't go in. They waited for Con Ed to get to the scene. We deal with the executives and the field people from Con Ed. And it's a way of improving the way we operate at utility emergencies. It seems like it's a small point, but it's not when you have a large electrical substation that's fire and nobody went in. They waited outside, and we got a plan of attack before we went in. We made sure it was de-energized. Seems like it's very simple, but that's not what happened years ago. So it was, again, a lesson learned from the past. So that there's, you know, I think when you look at different things that you can do as a department, I think you need to get input from the field, too, and see what do you need? What do you feel you need to help get the job done? Not only what I'm going to give you, but what do you need from me? I think it has to be a two-way street. You know, communication is going down is one thing. Communication coming up is more important. And I think when the people in the field see that and know that, I think you'll get more buy-in.
If you can make that work in an organization as large as yours, then you know there's a lesson for the rest of us with smaller organizations.
Well, it's getting the company offices to buy in, and we ask them to send in reports, send in things that you think will need to be improved, and we'll act on them.
Yeah. Billy, you had the experience of coming up in small departments, like what, two stations, three stations?
Two stations. Mm-hmm.
And now moving up to D.C. And that in that smaller environment, you had pretty close contact with the people. You probably got to see most of the people most days.
I did.
So that relationship was, you know, more one-to-one. Yep. Did you go to a lot of effort to carry the banner, to communicate to people what you thought was important and to empower them to make change?
I did. I thought it was very important for the crews and the personnel to understand who I was. And obviously, I had that luxury of being in a small organization when we had recruits come in and we did our own burn schools at burn buildings. I was the first one in with them because I wanted them to understand that I was willing to go in. I understand the sacrifices they make, and I'm not asking them to do anything that I'm not willing to do. But if I got in the apparatus, I put on a seatbelt. If I pulled out on a scene, simple thing, it seems like it's so simple, pull out on the roadway for a motor vehicle crash, first thing I do when my lights are on, go to the back of the truck and put my vest on and my helmet on. And, you know, that I saw the change occur and where our crews. We got them the vest. We got them street signs, the collapsible street signs, simple things to throw up, so an emergency scene ahead. They would put them out. They start deploying them. They understood where I was coming from. Obviously, with my commitment with the Everyone Goes Home program, had a huge influence on that. So they knew that we had to be a banner for that. I can tell you a quick story about when I mentioned a department I knew of that did a defensive operation if they had full accountability. Not defensive, but exterior operation. I said that shortly after Stephen Solomon in Atlanta, which you and I both were on the investigation group. I told one of my shifts that I met with all three shifts. Not a week later, we had a structure fire in a residential property, and the company officer, the first engine in, pulled up. They had heavy fire showing out of the AB corner. They eventually found it on the C side as well. But they had residents who were in the structure actually pulling furniture out. They were no more concerned about their safety. They just wanted to get their furniture out. And the lieutenant told me when I got to the scene, I said, you know, how'd you attack the fire? They said, you know, we thought about what you said. Everybody was outside. We had heavy fire showing. We went to the D side carport, tried to hit it with a straight stream. We never heard a drop of water hit the ground. There was so much heat in there. I said, so what'd you do, lieutenant? He says, we hit it from the outside. He said, the fire went out. We hit it from the window. I said, the fire went out. He says, yeah. And if they would have gone in, right after that, the roof caved in on them, caved into the house. So that one story really solidified and gave value to what I was trying to tell them. So it made a huge impact. But that's hard to do, again, when you're pulling up on scene and everybody's saying, you know, you got to get after it because everybody expects the firefighters to go in. It's a hard pill to swallow and say, we got to wait for the resources. If you got a two-in, two-out rule, you got to abide by the rules. It's not just something on paper. So it's difficult for smaller organizations. But I can tell you, working in D.C. now, the phenomenal job that the D.C. Fire and EMS Department does, when you have that amount of resources come up and the expertise, but the assignments and how they stick to the assignments. If the first two engines laying out and going to the A side of the building, giving the report, the other engines, the other truck companies, they all know what they're going to do. It's very structured, but that's a luxury knowing you have those other resources coming and that game plan is going to work.
Yeah, your box assignment in D.C. is 5 engines, 2 trucks, and a rescue squad?
Rescue and 2 battalions.
And 2 battalions.
And then if it's called out as a working fire dispatch from the first arriving scene, then they strike the safety alarm, deputy chief of operations, air unit. So we send a cachet of resources to them.
Yeah, which is an impressive force when there's a fire.
But in a smaller organization, when we had a hotel fire that killed 5 people in June of 2007 in Riverdale, we pulled resources from all over Clayton County. We were obviously depleted, but we were having to pull resources from 2 other counties, not only to backfill our stations, but to the county stations as well. And it took a while to get those resources there. So,
yeah. On that fire, how many people did you have from the initial assignment?
For my department,
yeah.
We had 1 engine and 1 truck.
Yeah.
And one battalion supervisor. And that's hard when you got heavy fire showing out of a commercial structure with reports of people trapped.
Yeah, it's a whole different game.
And that's probably Greg Collier. I think that's what's important, especially for our listeners to realize. The majority of the fire service in this country deals with those situations every day. And they don't have the capability of what many or some metropolitan cities have, is to quickly get those additional resources. They have to do things small. My department, until recently, had staffed 5-man companies, unusual for suburban town. We went down to 4 because of injuries and leaves and overtime, and now we're down to 3. And I've heard companies say things like, they're on-scene report, and they say they're doing it an exterior operation. They're waiting for 2 in and 2 out. I've heard people criticize that and not criticize it. You know, they applaud it. But is that not one of our size-up factors, that the next in company is realizing what they have to do to help them? If there is an immediate life hazard, they take care of that. And to get back to your question, my department, we provided the Courage to Be Safe training to our members within the organization and without. We did some training in our fire academy, and our department actually authorized overtime. One day there was a seminar at our county, and they said, anybody wants to go to that, and you fill out an overtime slip. That was remarkable. We use the near-miss reports. I can't tell you how often I walk into a firehouse and they're on the kitchen table. And is that not, in our culture, is that not a place where we get a lot of communications done at the kitchen table? NIOSH reports there. And again, our people are very intelligent. Sometimes we all do things not as well as we could, but we have very intelligent people that can take those reports, and they can see what they're doing wrong. They can see what can be better. And again, working together, the senior personnel, the officer, the younger people sometimes can say things that really help us. And I think that's important. That's important for our listeners to understand too.
Yeah, you have the dimension of career and volunteer within the same department.
Correct.
Do you have different approaches for bringing the message to the volunteer part of the department as to the career part?
Our department, we strive every day to treat everybody the same. And I'm a career battalion chief, and sometimes people will ask us, are you guys paid or are you guys volunteer? And I tell them we're a combination. And some people think you're one and the other, and I make it clear that we're not. We are a combination. That is a different type of organization. And I say to them, as far as you're concerned, you can't tell the difference. And we strive for that. We know internally whether they're career volunteer, that we have different levels, but that's what your team effort does, and that's what
if you do it right, they should look exactly the same.
Exactly. Exactly.
Pete Rizzo here, Chief. Chief Collier's remark regarding the coffee table chat, that's an invaluable piece of our culture. I know Billy Hayes isn't fond of that word, but it truly is. And Chief Cassano, I'd like to ask you if we couldn't, the Pass It On program, wonderful program, could we get that to the Internet so we could share that globally, basically?
Sure.
I mean, that's a wonderful program.
Absolutely.
you know, we do see, and this is true also globally, we do see the incidents, rare occasions of our technical rescue, let's say confined space, for example, where, yes, many points need to be covered prior to making an entry, be it rescue or recovery. Low frequency incidents, high risk. But I see a present, and I envision a near future of by utilizing proper equipment, technology as it becomes available. And we know, I think we're familiar with the fact that there's a tremendous amount of technology on the military side that just hasn't reached us yet. I envision the full-on engagement, the no-holds-barred fight to continue using those tools and equipment and procedures, and we can still get it done safely. So the folks don't misunderstand the fact that we're going to be holding back. We're not going to be holding back. We're going to be utilizing everything that's available in our cache, get the job done. That tradition is not going to change whatsoever.
No, I think we're going from what some say we're going to a weaker fire service. That's not the case. We're becoming a smarter fire service. What you just hit on, I think you're right. I think what we're training individuals to do now is with the technology that you're talking about, we're instilling it in their brain early on that those resources are there. The Chief, you mentioned about going to an exterior operation. Mm-hmm. We're now teaching people that. So that's more tools in their toolbox. When they arrive on scene, here's more in their thought process. So I applaud what both of you just said.
Yeah, we're so much better equipped than we used to be with, you know, just – things like, you know, thermal image cameras that, you know, have been around now, I guess, 15 years or so since they first came out. Now, everybody has one, and we look at it and say, how did we get by without these things? And you know, and radios and
Blackberries.
Blackberries and Nextels.
Pass alarms. Yeah. Vibe alerts.
Yeah. Well, first pass alarms, and then integrated pass alarms, and yeah. You know, and then that the heads-up display. Mm-hmm. If you look at what we have today versus what we had 20, 30, 40 years ago, it's phenomenal. And probably for a lot of the people in the fire service today, they, you know, seen a little bit of change. Something new came along, and something new. But when you stand back and say how much it has changed over, you know, 30 or 40 years, how much more it's going to change over the next few years.
We now keep a CO monitor with us while we're doing follow up or overhaul, and the sewer guys have been monitoring the sewers for 20 or 30 years mm-hmm. before they go in there. We are leap years ahead.
We're starting to put the reflective striping on our turnout gear or PPE that the DOT has had for years as well. I mean, we're not reinventing anything new. We're just trying to pick up on what we should be doing.
Yeah. Small steps for a big difference.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think one of the other things that we've gotten better at is looking at situations that went bad.
Right.
It used to be, you know, when we had firefighter fatalities or serious injuries, nobody worried about it very much because we were so used to it happening. But, you know, now whenever we have fatalities, they're looked at closely and they're examined, and I think they're examined very technically and in great detail, and you know, we're more focused on figuring out what went wrong so it doesn't happen again than covering up the fact that maybe somebody screwed up. And you know, I think FDNY was one of the leaders. I go back to some of the fatality investigations that FDNY was doing 20 years ago.
Yeah, we started in 1981.
Yeah.
After we had a serious roof rope dual fatality, and since then we've taken a very critical look at this. But I think the point of ensuring to the field is it's not looking at what went wrong in the field only. It's did the department shortchange the people that were at that scene? Did they not have the proper equipment? Was there something out there better that we didn't have that could have prevented that? And I think when people realize that this isn't just to point fingers at the people that were working, because it's a difficult job. Even when things are done correctly, it's a dangerous job. And we have to remember that. And it's a matter of, did we fail you by not giving you the proper equipment or the tools that are available?
The tools, not only, or the equipment or the training.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We never let training, you know, when you walk out of our fire academy, there's a sign there, never let your training fail you. And that's extremely important because the way we train is the way we fight fires. And people have to realize that. Just, you know, we think we're all talking about a big change, but Frank Brannigan, who was years ahead of his time, said in his first book, which was probably published 50 years ago, that if nobody is in that building, the only life has it is to the firefighters. So he saw that as a vision many, many years ago. And, you know, that's the message we're trying to get out, that firefighters, maybe the only life has it there. So just take an approach where you measure the risk before you do things.
Yeah. There's no dishonor in avoiding foolish risk. Mm.
So true.
And I think it's important, this, Billy, I think it's important that we point out, when you look at the total number of firefighters in our nation, I know Pete and Greg teach this when they go out with the courage to be safe, and you look at 100 line-of-duty deaths a year, and people say, wow, you know, 100 line-of-duty deaths, but you got millions of firefighters. But there's also over 100,000 firefighters who are injured every year that just did not get to that catastrophic point. So I don't think we just need to say, well, 100 is the number. We really have to look at the larger scale of how many close calls within that 100,000 could have added to the other number. So I think it's important to relay that, because people really look at raw numbers and they become disillusioned as to what the real problem is. And the other thing I would point out real quick before we carry on is, with the 16 initiatives, a lot of people say, that's too many. That's just too many initiatives to try to implement. Well, if you really look at what you're doing, you're already implemented some of those initiatives. They're already there, and you've been doing them. It's just focusing on them. And which ones can we do today to make a difference? Those are the ones we have to focus on, and I think that's going to be a focus of the Everyone Goes Home program in the next year, is going from a shotgun approach to a sniper approach. Where can we make the difference today?
Yeah, you know, people talk to me and say, you know, when the 16 initiatives came out, we had those ideas of reducing fatalities by, you know, 25% in 5 years and 50% in 10 years, which seemed like a really good idea. But 5 years have gone by now, and, you know, at least statistically, we don't see a lot of impact. But I think when we look seriously at what it takes to really make a difference, it's awfully hard to turn an aircraft carrier around in a narrow channel. But, you know, I see a lot of progress being made. Things are happening. We're setting the stage. But there's still a lot more to do. Are we doing the right stuff? Are we moving in the right direction? Pete?
I believe we are. I believe there's a real pride in ownership out there and doing the right thing. Unfortunately, we don't need to look too far to know someone who's had a life-altering injury from the fire service activities. But I truly believe that the message is being put forth. I think it's being received well. And I see things going in the right direction, no doubt.
Greg, how does it look from New Jersey view?
Well, I believe we are moving ahead. I think we have to keep advocating our program and similar programs. I think what we have to, our charge has to be, though, is to empower the American Fire Service to do that. We call this a grassroots program. It's their program. We just have to empower them to be able to do this. Chief Cassano just mentioned about what they're doing about looking at the line of duty deaths and injuries, and looking at the data, evaluating it, seeing where they failed them. That meets three of the initiatives right there. And many departments do that. So I think we're moving there. Can we stop? No. Because when we get to zero, you know, if we can do all these things that we do, Billy mentioned about what can you do and how can you change deaths and or injuries. If we do this seatbelt thing and get to zero, we've taken care of 34% of it right there. We're done. But they're the things we have to do to, and again, empower people to do those things.
Yeah. Give people the courage to be safe. I mean, that part of the program, I think, is so well named, about the courage to be safe, because it's easy to go along with the old way. It takes courage to step up and say, you know, we're really going to be safe. We're going to focus on it, and that comes down to the individual. It comes down to the company officer. It comes down to everybody in a leadership position in the fire service really has to take it seriously to make it work. You're making it work in the nation's capital, Ben?
We are. Chief Willie Flint is our safety officer, and some of the things that the District of Columbia Fire EMS is just in the year I've seen, and again, this is just a 34,000 feet view, is the safety vest, and now you see crews backing the apparatus into the bays off of the street. They're getting off the rigs with their vest on, which is, a huge change. And you know, you got to celebrate that. You got to celebrate that success and say, well, that's not enough. That was a huge step in getting them to do things like that. Getting them to go and take the 12 lead EKGs and do the stress test, finding the funding to make sure that happens and encouraging them to be safe, and you see firefighters out walking. Those are the positive things you have to celebrate, capture that. I think as the general courage to be safe, Chief, you mentioned this, we've got to celebrate a success, meaning that if we continue to beat ourselves up in the fire service saying, oh, geez, we're still killing 100 firefighters every year, let's look at the numbers. Last year we lost 13 in air disasters between helicopters and air tankers. If you take out those, have we improved? If you look at the number of individuals over the age of 70 we lost as line of duty deaths from whatever cause it may have been last year, if you look at and say, have we made differences in our structural firefighting? Have the numbers gone down because individuals are wearing seat belts? We had people shot as soon as they got off an apparatus last year. Those are things we can't control. But the things we can control, I think we're making a difference. And you're right, the courage to be safe, such an appropriate name to do that.
Yeah. And one thing we can't forget is the whole health, wellness, fitness side of it, because usually half of our fatalities are related to that side of the program. And the more emphasis we put on everybody being fit to do the job and having medical evaluations to know if they have problems, I think that that's just as important as the operational side that we tend to focus on.
That's correct. This is Sal from FDNY. And you're correct. We have a wellness fitness program where firefighters are given an annual medical, and they're taken offline for that day and are given a full comprehensive medical, and then we do some required training in addition. And that's a big commitment on the department's part, to take 6 units a day out of service, offline, and give them physicals. And it's been tremendous. We have picked up people that probably would have been working in the field and had a heart attack if it wasn't for that medical. And it's a big success.
Yeah, and that's been a big psychological struggle to say, we're not doing this because we want to weed people out. We're doing this because we want to identify people who are have potential problems and save their lives.
We did. We've saved lives.
Yeah. I think all the departments that have done that on a big scale have had that experience of identifying people who were really on the way to something critical and saving lives and preventing bad things from happening. Well, I think we've used up all of our allotted time. I think we had a really good discussion. I want to thank our participants, Pete Rizzo, Greg Collier, Billy Hayes, Chief Sal Cassano, and myself, Gordon Routley. I want to thank Firehouse and Firehouse Expo for giving us the opportunity to be on the air. We hope we've brought some good information to everyone out there who's listening, and please continue to implement the 16 life safety initiatives and to focus on everyone goes home at the end of the day, at the end of the shift. Let's make safety our number one priority. Thanks very much.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.